Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another Phoenix Mars Lander Media Telecon for Wednesday, June 11th. I'm Jane Platt with the Media Relations Office at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And we will be going over to Tucson and Sarah Hammond with the Public Affairs Office at the University of Arizona. She will introduce the speakers and then we'll go to Q&A after we hear from them. Visuals for today's briefing are posted online at www.nasa.gov/Phoenix. If you decide you want to ask a question, just press star one and we'll get you in the lineup. Let's turn things over to Sarah Hammond in Arizona. Good morning.
Thanks, Jane. Good day, everybody from Tucson. We have two speakers today, Peter Smith, our principal investigator for the mission from the University of Arizona, and William Bill Boynton, B-O-Y-N-T-O-N, the co-investigator for the Thermal and Evolved Gas Analyzer from the University of Arizona. Peter, why don't you begin?
Well, since the beginning when we landed, we've been studying the soil that we've landed upon, and it's quite interesting and I think very unusual. From the first look at the footpad under the lander, we could see that we broke through a very thin crust on the surface. So the soil is definitely layered in the sense that the very top surface layer is crusted, and then underneath is some looser soil. And, of course, when we looked under the lander, we saw, holy cow, the exposed hard layer that most people suspect is ice, but we have yet to verify that. And then we've been using our arm to dig into a part of our terrain called Dodo, and we've been digging a trench, and we have a picture of the latest view of the trench. And clearly you can see that there's some white material exposed in the trench. There's a debate as to whether this might be a salty layer or just an ice layer, but definitely it extends right beneath the surface, just about 5 centimeters or two inches down below the surface. And again, in this picture, you see what looks like clods that apparently are broken off from this crusty surface layer. We also know now that not only is it crusty and tends to clump into little balls, but when you deliver it to a sloped metal surface like the Tega, which is sloped at about 45 degrees, it sticks to the side of the surface. It's apparently a very sticky material, too. Now, whether it's electrically sticky or has some chemical property that holds it together is unknown. But this is definitely an interesting material and quite a bit different than all the Mars simulants that we were working with in our laboratory doing testing. So one of the things we're really interested in doing over the next day or two is to get a microscopic examination of this soil to try and understand its properties. One other property I failed to mention is the first time we pressed the robotic arm into the soil, you could actually see the imprint of all the fine details on the back of the scoop, even screw heads and little metal joints that make up the scoop. They're imprinted in the soil just like you might take a fine powder and make an imprint in it. So there must be some very fine, small-sized material here, which has made it very confusing for us as we see this material stick to the side of a sloped metal surface, which is very smooth and one would suspect slippery, and fail to go through some of the screens on the Tega instrument. So we're quite interested to see the microscopic makeup of the soil. Our microscope will allow us to look at the magnetic properties, to examine the size distribution. Is it all fine materials, or there's some kind of larger, thornier sort of grains that make it sticky? And finally, we can look at the different colors of the grains and to see if they're made out of different compositions. But I'm quite encouraged with this soil because it looks to be just the kind of unusual chemical, mineral, and perhaps size distribution type of soil we're hoping to find. In other words, we can't understand it yet without using our instruments, which is why we brought them. But there's also been a really wonderful new development with the Tega instrument, and Bill Boynton's going to tell us a little about that.
Yes, as many of you are aware, we've been having some problems dealing with this very crusty material, and it's been not very cooperative about trying to work its way through the screens and get into the very small ovens that we have in the TIGA instrument that are going to be used to heat up the soil for our analyses. Well, it turns out for the last several days, we've been running our vibrator sometimes several times a day, just kind of in the off chance we might get lucky and some of the dirt would fall through the screen. Last night, we got some data down, actually early this morning, and found out that in the run where we were actually running the vibrator for the what probably would have been the last time we would have done it, was the seventh time that we ran it, we found that the program actually terminated early, and we were a little surprised at that, and then once we looked at the data, we realized why. The fact was that the dirt finally did start to flow, and we actually got a full oven. So we're that problem is now behind us. We're ready sometime in the next day or two to close the ovens and actually start the process of the analysis. So we're really very excited and very pleased and ready to get on with things. Sarah, I guess I'll turn things back over to you.
Okay, Jane, that's our presentation. We'll be open for questions.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. And again, if you have a question, press star one so we can get you in the lineup. And on this first round, again, I would ask that you reporters please keep it to one question and one follow-up so we can give everybody a turn, and then we'll go back for another round if necessary. I did want to mention that we do have two very important Phoenix team members here with us at JPL this morning, Barry Goldstein, the project manager for Phoenix, and Dave Spencer, the deputy project manager. So in the event you have questions that would pertain to their areas, feel free to pose questions to them. And panelists, again, if a question is not directed specifically toward you by name, I would ask that you just identify yourself even by first name when you respond. That really helps out a lot. Let's take our first question from Jeremy Monnier of the Chicago Tribune. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks a lot. So, Bill, what then will be the schedule with the TIGA now? When do you expect to be getting the first readings back, and how long is it really going to take to get some first gleanings from that analysis?
Well, we're hopeful that sometime in the next few days we will close the oven and begin the analysis process. Now, the analysis process really takes about 5 days. We have 4 days of heating the samples to different temperature limits and an intervening day to actually bake out the mass spectrometer to remove any water vapor that we might have gotten from an earlier day's run. So it's probably a week-long process once we begin. By the end of that time, should have some preliminary ideas of what we're seeing. The instrument's really designed to get very quantitative results, and it's likely to be several weeks after that before we really have definitive scientific numbers. But we should have a pretty good idea somewhere in the order of a week or so after we begin.
Thanks.
Next question is Dave Perlman in San Francisco for the Chronicle.
Yeah, good morning, and I have a small problem, and I'm sorry about that. I dialed into the right number and kept getting voicemail from the system. And so I have no idea who was talking at the very beginning. And so I have no names.
Okay.
And
could
you help?
Sure. I'll help you out with that. And let's talk afterwards to see what might have gone wrong with you dialing in.
Yeah. Who said it was very crusty anyway? Please tell me that.
Peter Smith.
Oh, okay.
And we've got Peter Smith, and we have Bill Boynton today also.
Oh, okay. All right. That's all I need. Thanks.
Okay. Well, that was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk afterwards about you.
Yeah, problem. You bet.
Okay. John Johnson, L.A. Times. John, are you with us? John Johnson?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. Does the difficulty of getting this sample into the TIGA change what your plans are for further testing? I mean, as I understood it, you were expecting to test as you went down. Are you still planning to do that, or does this mean you will skip from here to the ice stage?
No, the plans are we will still take probably one more surface soil at least, which is going to take us some while to dig down to the ice stage, but my guess is we may be 3-4 weeks, something like that, before we actually get to sampling ice.
Thank you.
And that was Bill Boynton speaking.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Thanks, Sarah. Next question is going to come from National Public Radio and David Kestenbaum.
Can you just lay out what exactly you might be able to tell from the sample once you actually start to analyze it?
Yes, and this is Bill Boynton again. What we'll be doing is, in the first case, looking for ice. The instrument can tell us how much ice is in the sample. When we heat up the sample, we will vaporize the water that constituted the ice and measure the isotopic ratio of the constituents in there. On subsequent days, when we heat it to higher temperatures, we'll see different minerals that decompose at high temperatures, and when they do so, they will give off water or carbon dioxide that they might have reacted with in the past. And by knowing the temperature at which this happens and the nature of the gases given off, we can identify which minerals they are. And the reason this is important is we're looking for evidence of past interactions with water. So if we see minerals that have water bound into their structure, we know that sometime in the past they've actually been in a wet environment where they've had a chance to acquire this water hydration.
Our next question is going to come from Ken Kramer at Spaceflight Magazine.
Hi, thank you. First, congratulations. That's a really excellent result. I wonder if you could describe, did you see the thousands of blinkings, and about how long did you vibrate it for altogether?
Yes, this is Bill again. And actually, this time we didn't see the many thousands of blinkings. Usually we don't have that many, but actually the once the oven started to fill, it went from empty to full in just a little over a second. It really just poured in once the dirt started flowing. We were shaking the system with the vibrator for about 5 seconds. Just for about 1 second before the dirt started to flow, and then it really cascaded and filled the oven up almost instantly.
And you said the vibration stopped. You were not expecting that. Is that what was pre-programmed?
Well, we were, yes, that was what was pre-programmed. The instrument is pre-programmed. Once it gets its internal oven full signal, it knows it doesn't need to go any further, and so it stops the vibrations and it terminates. We were not really expecting that just because we weren't very optimistic that after we've already vibrated this thing many, many times, that this particular one was going to work. So we were very surprised to see that it stopped early.
So why does it take a day or two to close?
I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Why does it take a day or two to close the oven? Thank you.
Oh, the oven will close. I mean, we can close the oven in about 15 minutes from the time we issue the command. It's just that at this point we weren't ready because we didn't know the sample was going to be sealed. So it's now just getting it into the queue and working it around all of the other things we want to do, and just studying things and making sure we've got every T crossed and I dotted for the process.
Yeah, this is Peter.
I'm sorry, did you have something you wanted to say, Bill?
Peter's adding into this too.
Okay.
Yes, We decided that today was going to be a day to deliver to the optical microscope, and so when we got the late-breaking news of the oven fill, there wasn't time to redirect the whole day's activities. So we're going to try and do it on the next sol that we have a chance to upload our sequences to, if we can get it in, and I'm sure we're going to try.
Okay, the next question is Dan Vergano from USA Today.
Hi, folks. Could you talk a little bit about delivering a sample for viewing by the microscope and how that's going to play out? We're not going to face the same sort of dumping sticky thing that we've seen here, have we?
No, we're certainly not. We've developed a new method now that we've found that the Martian soil has got unusual properties and different than the materials we've worked with in the past. We found a new way to deliver samples, and that is to tilt the scoop with its load of soil in it, and then use our power tool that we use for digging into ice as sort of a vibrator, and we sort of just sprinkle material out. It's kind of a salt shaker mode, if you like, or a sprinkler mode, and we'll be doing that over the microscope collection surfaces, and we've practiced this before, and we know it's going to work well, so we have every confidence we won't get into a similar problem with too much material and sticking in place and that sort of thing.
And its results would be in about?
Well, we're sending up the commands today. The data will start to be taken, and we should start to get pictures back tomorrow. It'll probably take 2 or 3 days to get all of them, but we should have a first look by tomorrow.
Very good. We like pictures. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you'll see them.
All right, thanks. Alan Fisher of Tucson Citizen, go ahead with your question.
This is a question for Dr. Boynton. Dr. Boynton, when you say that the TIGA oven was filled, what kind of quantity are we looking at from that standpoint?
The ovens are really very tiny. They're a little over 2 millimeters in diameter and about a centimeter long. It works out to 30 microliters, and I'm afraid I don't know how to convert that to any reasonable units that people might understand, but it's a tiny fraction of a teaspoon. And so it, you know, once the dirt starts flowing, it doesn't take long to fill it up.
Okay. And as a follow-up to that, Peter just described the salt shaker method. Is that going to be used to fill up the other 7 TIGA ovens, that same technique of shaking a small amount of material on? Because you had said earlier you were concerned about not getting enough material into TIGA, but we'll be using the salt shaker method in the future?
That is our intention, and right now we don't know exactly how long it takes, how much shaking of the salt shaker we'll need to do, but we will be collecting data and looking at our signal of particles going by to fill the oven, and the first time we'll do it slowly and take some data along the way, but that is, in fact, the approach we'll be using for all of the other ovens.
Thank you, sir.
Next question comes from Steve Futterman at CBS Radio Network.
For either one of the gentlemen.
Steve, can you speak up? You sound like you're in a soup can.
I sound like I'm on Mars, maybe. For either of the gentlemen, I got on a bit late. When did the actual oven fill take place? When was this process going on? When was it completed? So just some basic information there, and then I have a follow-up.
Okay. This is Bill Boynton. We got the data back this morning that the oven fill actually happened overnight during Mars Day, but we got the signal back from the instrument, even though we had previously on several days been shaking and without any good results. This time the vibrator actually managed to deliver the dirt into the oven, and that's where we are. We found out just several hours ago.
And my follow-up, I'd like to know if you why you may have had some problems early on. In initially, you said there are different properties than you expected to see with the dirt, and why it wasn't working when you began the shaking process, and why it's working now, you think?
Well, we think it's because the dirt is very clumpy, and it's difficult. It's got a lot of cohesion to it, so it's difficult for it to pass through the screen that we have. We have a screen with 1 millimeter holes in it that the dirt has to go through, and it looks for reasons, as Peter said, we don't really understand completely why, but it does look like the soil is rather cohesive and tends to stick together.
Okay, the next question is Andrea Thompson, space.com.
Hi. Is it just the sort of surface crusty part that is being clumpy, or is the soil sort of all the way down so far, or can you tell?
Well, as far as we can tell, it's clumpy all the way down. The surface tends to be crusted, but if you pick up a scoop of soil that has both that crusty part and the stuff underneath, it tends to clump into little tiny clods. And these don't have much strength, if you dropped one on the table, it'd shatter into a little dust. But apparently it just likes to clump together. That's one of its properties. I'm kind of excited, actually. This is quite different from the type of simulants we've been told to expect to find on Mars. So the chemistry and the mineralogy of this material and the microscopic examination should be very interesting.
Great. Thank you.
We're going to take a question now from Ashley Yeager at Science News.
Hi. I just had one quick question. Does the vibrator method change how much soil you'll put into the scoop for future samples?
This is Bill. No, not really. What we'll be doing differently, we'll probably have about the same amount of material in the scoop, but we're just going to be vibrating it out of the scoop more slowly. We really, if this hasn't been clear, we've got kind of two different vibrators. The scoop itself has a vibrator, and it's actually an instrument that's designed, as Peter said, as a tool to grind into the ice, but it serves double duty as a vibrator. And then the TIGA instrument itself has a different vibrator that gets the soil through the screen and down through the funnel into the oven.
Yeah, this is Peter. It's a little like sifting flour. If you put flour into a sieve, it doesn't tend to go through the holes, even though it's smaller. You have to bang on it, and then it goes through quite nicely.
Okay, thank you.
Now we're going to take a question from Arizona, Aaron Mackey at the Arizona Daily Star.
Thank you. Peter, you had said that the soil is exhibiting some unexpected properties. I'm wondering what the team's doing in Tucson maybe to try to simulate this in the pit or in other experiments as you guys try to move along through the mission.
Well, they're kind of pulling on their beards at the moment, wondering just how to make some of this stuff. It's going to be very helpful to get our microscopic examination and at least know what the sizes of the little grains are. So we're taking some very fine material, it's like a powder, and we're mixing it with river sand, and we're trying to make that a sticky mixture, but so far we haven't been all that successful. It tends to go right through the TIGA screens with no problem at all. So there's something missing in our mixtures here that I'm quite anxious to find out what it is.
All right, thank you.
Now we're going to take a question from Jonathan Grupper at WGBH.
Congrats again to both of you guys and the whole team. Just to get specific with the timing here, the first look by tomorrow is what you said, and I'm assuming that's Earth time. What time is I'm assuming it's uplink as well. What time do you expect that to be?
To see the microscopic pictures, you mean?
To see the results. Were you referring to the results from TIGA or from the microscope?
The microscope. We're sending up the commands for the microscope today.
Okay.
And TIGA's oven will, according to our current plan, be closed, and Bill will be starting his analysis in the next thaw, so that'll be 2 days from now.
Right.
And,
it would be the following morning, Earth time, that you'll be getting the first results from TIGA.
Yes, and that's a low-temperature bake that tells you how much ice is in the soil.
That sounds
so
good.
And maybe Bill would like to say more about that.
Yeah, in fact, we really don't expect there to be much in the way of ice in this soil now because it's been sitting out in the sunshine for, I don't know how many days now, 3, 4, or 5 days, something like that, trying to get through the screen. And, in fact, one of the hypotheses is that maybe there was some ice in there and that it has sublimated away, freeing up some of the strength that the soil might have had. That's, just speculation right now, but it does look like the soil has changed somewhat.
So that would be Friday morning Earth time?
That's correct.
And you'll be getting data as well as pictures?
Now, you're mixing things together. We've got a TIGA oven, which has no camera, and we have a microscope, which is going to be looking at the grains, so that we can understand the properties of the soil a little better. And the microscope has been commanded today to receive a sample and to do the first part of its scan of the sample. And if that all goes well, we'll have the first pictures from the microscope tomorrow. And TIGA won't be commanded until tomorrow, and it'll be giving you get your water scan the first day?
Yeah, we'll get some data back the first day, but it'll be very difficult to interpret, and probably the most we'll be able to say in that first day is there was a little bit of ice in it, or there was not much ice in it. And as I said, we don't really expect to see much in the way of ice. We're just be, in this case, glad that the, you know, the analysis goes through to completion without any hitch.
Yeah, that'd be good.
The next question is going to come from Alicia Chang at Associated Press. Alicia?
Yes, hi. I was wondering, you know, with scientific studies starting on TIGA and the microscope, I mean, what's your short-term plan now?
The short-term plan is to try and understand the first look at these two materials, make sure our instruments are performing as we expect and that we understand how to deliver this unusual Martian soil, unusual in the sense that it's hard for us to create soil like that in our laboratory, at least until we know more about it. And then we will be beginning to dig a trench in an area of our digging area, our workspace called Wonderland, which is on the very right-hand side, looking from the arm perspective. And that's an area that we think is in the center of one of these polygons that we've noticed from space and have seen all around us. One of the little hummocks. So it'll be kind of the highest portion of our digging space, and we'll start digging a trench. First thing we'll do is deliver three surface samples from that trench to TIGA, the microscope, and the wet chemistry lab. So that'll be our next set of samples.
So are you going to skip the wet chemistry this time around?
Yes, we are, and the reason is there's only four wet chemistry cells. So we want to be digging in the place where we think we have our best scientific opportunities. And also the wet chemistry lab is not quite ready with its sequencing blocks to receive a sample. So that will be happening over the next few days, too.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go to Henry Bortman of Astrobiology Magazine.
Hi. I think this is for maybe both of you. First of all, congratulations on getting the sample in the first oven. Are there any soils on Earth that have properties similar to what you're seeing on Mars, and what are the instruments, the microscopic imager and the TIGA, going to be able to tell you about why this soil is behaving the way it is?
Well, Earth has a tremendous variety of soils. This is Peter, and I am sure that we can find analogs of exactly this type of behavior once we know what's going on in this soil chemically and with the minerals and with the grain sizes. I'm sure we'll be able to find examples. We just haven't been using those in our current testing in our laboratory. So I don't think it's probably something that you can't find on the Earth. It's just we haven't known where to look for this kind of analog.
Okay, we're going to take a question now from Brian Rivlin at the Albany Times Union.
Yes, I was wondering if the vibrator is away from the power that could be used for the microscope at all, and if that is becoming a problem, because you said earlier that you were running the vibrator for several times a day. Hello?
Yeah, we're trying to understand the question.
I think you're mixing the two instruments together. We have a vibrator on the scoop that helps us get sample out of the scoop and into the entry ports, and that is...
Oh, no, I was wondering, you're using the vibrator on the TEGA, and I was just wondering if that was complicating the use of the microscope at all.
The microscope is part of a different instrument in a different box on the deck. So they have no relationship, really.
Yeah, and we would not be running the vibrator while the microscope is trying to take its images, if you're wondering about vibration or something.
No, the overall power, if that was complicating the microscope, if you couldn't use the microscope because you were using the vibrator too much because it was clumped up.
Well, we do that at different times of day, so the activities Bill's been doing with TIGA take place over short periods of time, and it's been happening several times a day, but we don't tend to do things at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll take a question now from Arizona Republic and Ann Ryman.
Hi, good morning. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what the microscope may tell you about the soil, and then also if you could refresh my memory about how big is this microscope?
Well, the microscope is about 6 inches long, but it has a sample holder that is a little wheel that's maybe 3 or 4 inches in diameter. And by moving this wheel back and forth, you can move it out to collect a sample and then rotate it around and move it back in front of the microscope to do an examination of the sample. So the whole thing is maybe 10 inches long and 4 or 5 inches in diameter. And what we hope to learn is we have 6 different collection ports for the microscope, and they have different type of substrates. Some are just little bins that just hold the soil. Others are magnets, and some are silicon surfaces that allow particles to stick. And by examining these various surfaces and the material that's collected on them, we can get some idea of the sizes of the minerals, their magnetic properties, their sizes, their shapes, and also their colors. We have 4 colors that we can look at it, and we can discriminate between different type of mineral grains. So this is really quite an extensive analysis that goes on with the microscope. But first thing we're interested in is just the size distribution. How big are these particles? And we only look at particles that are smaller than 200 microns. The rest of them won't come into the microscope stage. They tend to get clogged up, and they're too big for us. So we'll only be looking at the very smallest particles.
Thank you. And if I could ask a quick follow-up, could you tell us a little bit about the reaction to the science team when they found out that the oven was, in fact, full?
Yes, this is Bill. I'd be glad to talk about that. Within our team, just the TIGA instrument group, we found out about this perhaps an hour before. We have a meeting called the midpoint meeting, and we decided to keep it quiet just within the group. And one of the things we do at this meeting is the moderator of the meeting goes around the table, asks for each instrument team to talk about the status of the instrument and if the data that came down was reasonable, if the instrument's working, usually just a 30-second type conversation. And when it came to me, I talked about a few other things and then said at the end we had a problem because the process terminated early, and normally that's a signal of something going wrong, but in this case it was a signal of something going very right. And then I announced that it terminated early because the oven was full, and the group just went up into cheers, and as Peter pointed out, I got a standing ovation, and we're playing some shake, shake, shake music, and we just had a good time for a minute or two.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to finish up with a couple of people who are asking their first questions of the day, and then we're going to go to those of you who would like to ask in the second round. So let's take a question now from Sally Rail at the Planetary Report.
Hi, can you hear me?
Absolutely, we can.
Okay, great. You've kind of danced around this, both Peter and Bill, and it is for both of you. Because of the 7th vibration being the successful vibration, and congratulations, by the way, is there any further confidence in any of the leading contenders toward ice or salt or something entirely Martian? In other words, is the debate heating up now because of what's happened with TIGA?
Well, I could start. This is Peter. I think there are very few people, if any, on the science team that believe there's no ice under this soil. We all believe the ice is there. The question is whether there's a little crusty layer of salt on top of it caused by evaporation. Perhaps the ice is melted. That would be something we'd be quite interested in, or perhaps some other reason. But I don't think there's many people that believe there's no ice under this soil. Bill, you want to add to that?
Yes, I agree with that. We all have a lot of confidence that we'll get down to the ice, and as Peter pointed out earlier, we may actually have even exposed some underneath the lander in the process of landing. The Wickel instrument is going to be very favorably disposed towards answering questions about salt. That's really what that instrument is designed to do. So right now we are speculating some way, you know, variety of different people with different ideas, but We hope in a time scale of a week or two to get enough data to be able to help address some of these speculations and see what theories are right and which ones are not.
Okay, great. But are you arguing heatedly, or are you just still jovially arguing?
Oh, it's still at the jovial stage. And we all know that it's just speculation, and without data, it's not much more than just guesses and things like that. So there's at least I'm not aware of any heated discussions at all. But Peter?
Well, there was a little bit of a heated discussion last night, and one of the scientists was claiming that the pattern of ice in the trench had changed over a few days. And others said, well, that's just the sun coming in at a different angle. It made it look like it was different, or in fact, it actually wasn't different. So they tend to kind of face into each other like the baseball manager and the umpire, you know, and pointing fingers. And that has changed. No, it hasn't changed. And so, you know, it's kind of at that level right now.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed that one.
Yeah, you missed that one, Bill.
Thank you.
All right, the next question, Mary O'Keefe from the La Cañada Valley Sun.
Yes, probably for Peter. Can you explain the shaking that you said, like a salt shaker over the microscope? Can you explain that a little bit?
Certainly. We have a scoop of material, and we start to crank the scoop around to where the material starts to slide towards the front. And at just that point, we try and stop. And then we have a little, it's kind of like a thumper in the back of the scoop that causes it to vibrate a little bit. And then the grains can kind of roll out the end of the scoop, and they come down in a fine little rain of particles. And the trick is to get that rain of particles over the entry point of the instrument and make sure that it falls into the right place. And to be sure that, we take pictures of that entry port right afterwards and assure ourselves that enough material has gotten into the instrument.
Thank you.
We are now entering what I affectionately like to call the bonus round. So if you have already asked a question, you're welcome to jump in now if you have another one, just by pressing star one. So let's take a question from Jeremy Monnier from the Chicago Tribune.
Thanks again. You might have covered this in previous conferences, but I just want to make sure I understand it. Sometimes I think people are confused about the whole process of communication between the ground and the lander, and how long an exchange, you know, takes, and what you need to, because it seems like, I mean, I don't I'm not bothered by this, but some people seem to get a little impatient with, you know, the tempo. what does that involve, and how long does it take to have sort of an exchange of commands to getting something back from the lander?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's a long process, of course, to first validate the commands and make sure we're not doing something foolish and sending up commands that'll either hurt the spacecraft or damage an instrument or move an arm into a solar panel. I mean, you really are having to check everything before you send it, because once it's up there, the machine just starts doing whatever you told it. So we have a long checking process that is very in-depth and detailed, and sometimes commands aren't ready to be sent up because they fail some of our tests. And then once we're ready to send the commands, we radiate them from here through a fiber optic to the Jet Propulsion Lab, and then they're sent to the appropriate antenna in the Deep Space Network, which is either in California or Australia or Spain, and it's radiated out to the spacecraft using an X-band frequency. And one of the orbiters, usually we've been using the Odyssey orbiters lately, and that'll receive the commands. And then once it's received the commands, it has to wait till it's over the lander itself to turn on the UHF antenna and radiate the commands down to the spacecraft. So that whole process can take anywhere from half an hour to an hour. And so that's what we have to deal with in terms of a delay. It's a 15-minute time delay just in the light time from Earth to Mars, but then there's another delay in kind of the getting from the spacecraft down to the surface. Does that answer your question?
I think so. And then are there certain times of day when you get messages back from the lander,
yes,
saying what it's been able to do and what pictures it's been able to take and so forth?
Absolutely. And so what we tend to do, there's two opportunities for us to do this communication, and we take one or two passes in the morning. That could be 4 a.m., 6 a.m., 8 a.m., somewhere in that time frame, and the commands will go from Earth up to the spacecraft, and sometimes we actually get some data down during that communication path. And then we do our operations during the Martian day, and late in the Martian afternoon, between 3 and, say, 6, we get one or two data dumps back from the spacecraft, and that's when we start our operations here on Earth. When the data comes back, we analyze it. That's when Bill got his data that said his oven was full. And right now, that was about, 6 a.m. that we got that data? So
about that time.
So we're kind of at an odd time of the Earth day here, but it's evening on Mars.
So the conversation is you have your part of the conversation mostly in the morning. It has its response for what it's been doing late in the afternoon. That's pretty much it for each day.
We do have some nighttime operations we've been doing. I know that Bill's Tiga instrument took some nighttime atmospheric observations. We're trying to coordinate with orbiters for nighttime atmospheric science. So we can operate at night.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot.
All right, we're going to jump to a question from Damian McLean of Bloomberg News.
Hi. Thanks very much. I'm wondering how you empty the ovens of soil once you've analyzed them.
This is Bill, and we don't empty the ovens. That's why we've actually built the instrument with 8 separate ovens. Each one is designed to be used once, and once the oven is filled and closed, we can never reopen it again. So we have those 8 ovens, and that's the only shots we have.
Thank you.
Next up is David Kestenbaum of National Public Radio.
Can you guys talk for a minute about just being near the North Pole? Why was that an interesting place for this mission to go to?
You discovered the ice.
Oh, this is Bill Boynton. One of the main reasons we went up there is because we found there was a lot of ice just beneath the surface. In fact, it was an instrument on board the Mars Odyssey orbiter that Peter was just referring to. It's another one that we've built here at the University of Arizona called a gamma ray spectrometer that actually discovered all of this ice just beneath the surface. So that was one of the real motivators for going there, with the idea that this ice is something we haven't been able to get to elsewhere on Mars, and perhaps the ice might even provide the kind of environment that might be preserving some organic molecules from the past, if indeed it is capable of preserving them. That's one of the objectives of the mission.
And which instrument would be able to detect those organic molecules?
That would be the Tiga instrument again, the same one we're talking about here.
And
the way we detect it is by heating up the sample in the oven, and the organic molecules would vaporize, and then our evolved gas analyzer can determine the nature of the constituents that come off as vapors.
Okay, we're going to go to John Johnson at the Los Angeles Times.
Bill, you described this celebratory event when you announced the oven was full. Was there really music being played, and how was it played? Was there somebody have a boombox or something in there?
It wasn't quite that sophisticated. I had a portable laptop computer in front of me that was all queued up with the sound, and after I made my announcement into a microphone that we all have, I just pressed the button to start playing the music and held the microphone near the speaker on the laptop. There was enough cheering and screaming and everything that I don't think anybody actually even heard the music, but
was anybody dancing around?
I was.
Dr. Boynton was dancing.
And the song?
I wish you could have been there.
I wish I could have, too. And the song was Shake, Shake, Shake?
Yes, indeed.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we have some interesting visual images today. I'm going to do a last call. If you do have a question before we wrap up, again, press *1 to get in the lineup. We're going to go right now, though, to Henry Bortman of Astrobiology magazine.
Hi, this is for Bill. Bill, Peter explain some details of what they'd be looking for in the with the optical imager to try and help figure out what the nature of the what's causing the clumpiness in the soil? Can you talk about what TIGA will be able to see that will help in figuring out why the soil behaves the way it does?
I guess a couple of things we might be able to see have to do with water. We suspect that water in one form or another might be at least one of the things that has something to do with the cohesion of the soil. So if there's any absorbed moisture on the surface of the grains when we begin to heat it, we should see that moisture being given off. And indeed, if there is any ice in the soils, when we do heat it, we'll see the effect of the melting of that ice. So we'll mainly be able to deal with the water and moisture ends of things. The wet chemistry lab, as I mentioned earlier, will be able to tell us about the nature of any salts that might be cementing the soils together.
Clays, too.
Yeah. Oh, not, yeah. Peter's right. The clay minerals is another thing we'll be looking at as well. They give off water at high temperatures when we heat those up as well.
So that's TIGA again.
That's TIGA again, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Going back now to Mary O'Keefe at the La Cañada Valley Sun.
Hi. The sticky material, the sticky soil, when you say that and the way you describe it, to me it sounds like Mississippi mud sticky. Is there any kind of earth description of it?
Well,
I know it'd only be visual, but...
You know, this is Peter. We'd love to have an earth description of it, but right now sticky replies to so many earth soils that I think we need more information, and that's where the microscope and the TIGA instrument is going to help us. And once we find out if there's clays or what kind of size of particles, if they're quartz or different kinds of, basaltic materials or whatever it might be, then we can start to find out where on earth we might find materials just like this. But right now, I don't think we have enough information. We wouldn't know where to start looking.
And
that's the power of these instruments.
And we're going to take a question from Spaceflight Magazine, Ken Kramer.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about the sprinkling that you did on Sol 15 on the lander deck. I was wondering about how long did that take, those series of very nice images that you put together, and can you guesstimate how much material you may have dropped?
Well, it was not much material, actually. It's probably 4 or 5 tablespoons. It wasn't really a lot of material. And it didn't take very long. I think maybe 10 or 15 minutes to do all of that. And so delivering samples is something we're getting better at every day. Now we're learning about the properties of the soil and how we have to handle it to get it into our instruments. And I think this is exactly what we needed to learn. Going to another planet and thinking we know the soils ahead of time is really kind of foolish. We really have to learn what we're sitting on here, what kind of soils we're dealing with. So it's taken a few days, and I know some people are impatient because of that, but I think we're at the end of that now, and we're ready to start all our science.
We're going to take a question now from space.com and Leonard David.
Hi, Leonard here. I just wanted to get back to both of you about the clumpy nature of the soil. Have we discarded hydrazine as far as the contaminant and how big the plume was that reached out from the lander?
This is Bill Boynton. I think our feeling there is that the, based on some lab experiments and so forth, is that the hydrazine would have been pretty well combusted on the way in, and the reaction products are nitrogen and ammonia. It's not thought that that would be much involved in this process. If there is any ammonia, the Wickel cell will be able to tell us. It's rather sensitive to that, but we really don't think that contributes much to the clumping. For example, when we dig away some of the surface soils and get soils beneath the surface that have been protected from the hydrazine from the rockets, it shows the comparable amounts of clumpiness.
Okay, thanks.
We're going to take a question from Carlos Martino from, and I do hope I get this right, Oestago J. San Paulo. Is that anywhere near correct?
Yeah, it's
okay.
Quite right.
Go ahead, Ben.
Well, I was thinking if I understood correctly, one of the causes of the flowing of the sample into the oven now could have been the drying of the sample by the time it stood exposed and shaken. Could this mean that all samples will have to be dried, that we won't be able to tell exactly how much water there is in this specific kind of merchant soil?
This is Bill Boynton again. We don't think that's going to be the case. If we had to deliver the samples the way the first one was delivered as a very large clump, then indeed it might have to dry out before it could get through the screen as this one did. What we're expecting, though, is when we use the sprinkler or salt shaker method of delivering the sample, that will fall more or less immediately right through the screen. So we're still quite optimistic that we will be able to preserve any ice and moisture associated with the soil grains and get it into an oven and get it sealed shortly after it's delivered to the instrument.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and that wraps up the Q&A, wraps up the media telecon. I want to thank all our panelists for joining us today, and I'll let all of you get back to work, and hopefully you'll be doing some more dancing and singing in the next few days. We're going to have an audio file of this telecon archived online at www.nasa.gov/phoenix and a couple of other sites as well. And for 7 days, we will have an audio file for replay at 1-800-925-0173. For international callers, 402-998-0031. And actually, the next media event will be this coming Friday, June 13th. That will be a televised briefing from the University of Arizona. That's going to start at noon, Arizona and Pacific time. And we'll be sending out an advisory about that. And again, a lot of images and info available both at the NASA site and at phoenix.lpl.arizona.edu, the U of A site. Any additional questions, call us at JPL Media Relations, 818-354-5011, or Sarah Hammond at the U of A, 520-626-1974. Thanks, everybody. Take care.